Okay, we begin here on the top of Tzadi Pei Daman Aleph with the new Perek. The Perek's continuing the theme of the previous two Prakim of a Mocher et Aspina, and before that, a Mocher et Abayit. Over here, it's slightly different because until now we've been trying to determine what is subsumed under a sale. We have an item that's sold, what's included under that item or what's not included under that item. Over here, the clarification is more along the lines of what is the intended purpose of the item that is being sold. Some items have multiple purposes, and then if he sells the item, how do we determine which purpose it was for, or which is considered to be the primary purpose of an item, and therefore in a sale, what is considered to be a valid sale, or if it's missing that, what's considered to be an invalid sale? Later on in the Perek, we'll get into other items of definitions of items. For instance, if you sell a plot of land for such and such, what's the definition of that plot? If you sell a shvile yachid, shvile rabim, what's the normal sizes of these items when people sell them? So what are the default structures or measurements of these sales? But that's later in the parak. Right now, we deal with items that are sold. Are they sold for a particular purpose? And if they don't function in that purpose, what's the din? So here begins, a mocher peirot lechavero, the person who sells fruits to his friend. Over here, he can use the fruits for one of two reasons. He can use them to eat, their edible fruits, or he can use them for their seeds to plant. So it's unclear when he sells the peirot to his friend whether he's going to plant them or whether he's going to eat them. Vizaran, v'lotzamchu, he planted them and they didn't grow. Or afilu zera pishtan, even if it is flax seed, which as the Rashbam points out, is ala rov used for planting and then growing flax, even though it does have alternate purposes, like eating sometimes, feed, or oil. But nevertheless, the rove is used for planting. Enu chayav achriutan. The seller has no responsibility if they don't grow, because the buyer at the time never made a claim that he's buying them for seeding. Since that's the case, the mocher can say, I thought you were buying them to eat. And that is a valid claim. It's a valid reason to purchase these items. And it's a valid assumption by the mocher. And since that's the case, he can say to him, I'm not going to warranty the fact that they didn't grow or you planted them as seeds. You talk about seeds for the garden, that are not edible. Then for sure, he is responsible, the seller, to replace them or warranty them if they don't grow. Because here, there's only one purpose for the seeds, and that's to be planted. Now he can't make a claim, I sold them to you to be eaten. They're not eaten. The only thing he could sell them to is be planted. If they fail as seeds to grow, then the seller is responsible. Now the Baal Tosafot already raised the issue. Wait a minute. Why should the seller be responsible? Maybe it was the buyer's fault. He didn't plant them properly. He didn't water them properly. He put them in the poor soil. There are many reasons why seeds might not grow. Nothing to do with the efficacy of the seeds. So the Baal Tosafot say over here, it must be a case where it either became clear after the fact, or the seller agrees to the fact that these were not viable seeds. That it's not a case where the failure of the seeds is determined by him planting it. And that's the only way we know that these seeds are not viable, but rather there's some other independent verification of the fact that the seeds did not grow or are not usable as seeding. And therefore the mocher then is responsible. Sometimes, because we'll see in the Gemara, he's not only responsible for the seeds, he's responsible for the expenditures undertaken by the buyer. The buyer here expended money to plant these seeds, and meantime, they weren't seeds that could grow. So the Gemara has an opinion that not only is the seller responsible for the seeds, but even for the expenditures the buyer undertook in order to plant these seeds. Well, that would only be true if you were certain that the seeds were not plantable or would not grow. So that's why Dalai Tosafot say over here that that is the situation that we are speaking about. Now the Gemara brings basically a Gemara that has nothing to do with our Mishnah, our Perek at all. Truth is that we've seen it already a number of times. We saw it back in Bava Kamma, seen it in Ketubot, seen it in a number of places. And that is when you have these types of Sfekot, how do we bring proof or evidence to either side, or how would we determine whether the buyer or the seller or the two parties, who is in the right? So Itmar, a mucher shor de chavero, person who sells an ox to his friend, benimsa nakhan, and we find out that it is a goring ox. Here it's not clear that he has to be a muad, simply that the ox is not as domesticated as you want him to be. And again here, there are two possible uses for an ox. One possible use is that you plow with it, you use it to pull the wagons and to plow with it. The other possibility is that you use it for its meat, that you're going to shecht it. So So now, if it's a nagchan, it shouldn't bother you if you're going to shecht it. The animal's not going to be around for very long. You're going to kill it and use it for meat. So the fact that it's a nagchan is really almost irrelevant because that's going to be finished very quickly. The other hand, if you're going to keep it around to plow and to carry wagons, pull wagons with, then it's a serious issue that this animal is a little wilder or problematic because it's going to cause damage. So Rav Amar, Arizeh Mekach Ta'ut. The person purchased it, and he finds that it's an achan, it's a failed sale, because of the fact that there were mistaken assumptions made over here. And then Shmuel Amar, Yechol Amar Lo, L'shchita Mechartiv Lecha. The seller can say, I sold it to you for its meat, and therefore there's no problem in what I sold you. The Rashbam already over here brings up the issue that we see in other places, which is that when we have a safek like this, we don't know whether he sold it for the purposes of shechita, or whether he sold it for the purposes of plowing. So now we're left in a safek. The Rashbam says that in many places, the Shas seems to pass him like sumchus. Sumchus is of the belief that mamona mutal with safek, chokim. When you have a safek about your mamon, you split it 50-50, and then the mocher takes 50%, the koner takes 50%, and that's how we just settle the issue. The Rashbam here, the Shitato, says that we paskin like sumchus, and that the locha is like sumchus. So his question then is, why is the Gemara not here just simply saying, we have a safek, let sumchus be the determining factor, and therefore we should split it between the mocher and the koner. There's no such suggestion in the Gemara. So for the Rashbam, that's problematic. He's got to figure out why over here, even though we would posit like sumchus in other places, that sumchus would agree in this situation that we don't do such a thing. The Balei Tosafot earlier in the Masechta already said that they thought that the Rashbam was incorrect in his assumption. And over there, the Rabbeinu Tam said, despite the fact that in many places in Shas, we find that we posit like sumchus, or that the Stam Gemara is like sumchus, nevertheless, the halacha is like the chachamim. Once you say the halacha is like the chachamim, then you have a motzi mechavero, ala baraya. The burden of proof is on the one who is trying to change the status quo. And then you can figure out what's happening over here. You can understand the circumstance. But for the Rashbam who thinks that Allah is like sumchus, he's got to come up with an explanation for that. And he explains over here that mamona mutaba safek chokim is only in a case where we don't know the facts of the case. It is a mechanism for determination when the facts are unknown or unresolvable. That's when you use it. Or in essence, the way that the Balei Tosafot call this is a drora de mamona, which is that the safek pre-exists, are showing up in court. The showing up in court is not going to change the fact that there was a safek. There was a safek whether we showed up in court or not. Now when we come to court, we're just articulating the safek. But the safek existed. For instance, if you don't know when the animal gave birth, it was before it was sold, after it was sold, nobody was there. There's no way to determine those facts. That's mamona mutaba safek. But in a situation where the facts are known, and it's a question of psak halacha, it's a question of law, there we don't use sumchus. And that's what the Rashbam indicates over here, that here it's not a question of the facts. All the facts are known here. The question now is a question of law. Who is correct over here? Whose position is right? The facts we know. There was a shor that was sold. The shor was sold, and it is a nagchan. The only question is now, when people buy, what are their assumptions? Or when people sell, what are their assumptions? That's a matter for the courts to determine. In that case, mamona mutaba safek is not a relevant mechanism for determining which way the money should go. And he says over here, the way that Rashbam concludes is, v'hacha sh'anu yudim he'achaya maseh, and all this information now is known, hacha modu sumchus tovi mamona mutaba safek. This is not called mamona mutaba safek, ala zilin batar ho sh'toin yafeh. Whoever has the better claim, the kevin deruba lov klum hu, since according to Shmuel, rove is not a determining factor, the burden of proof was on the buyer, not the seller. So for the main brother, Raja Kobinanle, he would have to articulate the fact that I bought it for that purpose. Or for Rav, where rove is kobeya, then the burden is on the seller to say why he is selling it. So that's why over here, we go after the other mechanisms of determination and not a mamona mutaba safek. So Gemara says, very simply, this is a person who buys it for possessions, meaning over here, for shechting, for meat, then it would be for meat. If it is that he buys it for plowing, then it should be for plowing. If this individual is a farmer who farms the land and is not a butcher, then we know when he's buying oxen, the reason he's buying oxen is to put on his plows. the guy's a butcher, then in that situation, it's pretty clear he's buying it for meat. So the circumstances or the context should be able to give us information about why the shor was sold. Why don't we look at that information? Now, the way that the Rishbam writes it is, it's a case where the buyer and seller know each other. According to the Rishbam, if the buyer is known to the seller, then the seller knows or should have known why the buyer is buying it. It is known in secular law as a warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, which means that when you sell it to someone and he's a farmer, then the assumption is that you are warranting that its purpose, it will be served, which is to plow. And similarly for the butcher, that you're selling it for the meat and that's the purpose. In most contracts today, they have a limitation that excludes that language. It says that there's no warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, because they don't want to be held to that standard. They don't want to be held to a particular purpose. But over here, what the Rashbam says, if you know who the guy is and you know why he would be buying Shvarim, then you should know that it's going to be used for that purpose. There are other Rishonim who say you don't even have to know him. As long as the other people in the city know him as a farmer or know him as a butcher, that's enough information that the seller could have found out about that information. But if that's the case, we could have known, and then why is there a question here at all? And here we're not really interested in what the mocher is thinking, is because the mocher just wants this thing sold. He doesn't really care why it's sold, he just wants it off his hands. So therefore, we're only searching for the intent of the buyer over here, not the intent of the seller, because the seller's intent is to sell. It doesn't have to do with what he's selling it for. The buyer is much more particular about why or what he's buying it for. It says, "Zagavra d'zavin l'hochi l'hochi." It's an individual who buys for both purposes. Either he is both a farmer and a butcher, or he is a broker, a middleman, who's selling and buying shvarim. So we have no idea why he's buying them, because he's not of a particular profession. And so therefore, there's no clarity in figuring out whether he bought it for plowing or for shchita, because we don't know from his profession as to which of the two reasons he would have bought it. Where it says, V'lechzei demei echininhu. Why don't we look at the price? As the Rishbam points out over here, many Rishonim make this a particular point. It has to be that there's a significant enough difference that it's obvious through the price. The cost of buying a shor for plowing is much more expensive than buying a shor for shchita, for its meat. So if I look at the price should be determinant over here. If he paid a lot of money for it, it's obvious that he's buying it for plowing purposes. If he paid less money for it, then it's clear he bought it for meat purposes. It should be easy to determine why he bought it because of that differential in price. And the price differential has to be big enough that it would be termed or deemed a mekach ta'ot. Otherwise, what's the relevance in the difference of price? It's under the differential of price that's considered to be michila, and therefore the sale will stand either way. So it has to be a situation in which the price is far enough apart by which that the Mekach would be a Mekach Ta'ot if it was sold for the other purpose. The Rashbam, the Balei Tosafot, all the Rishonim are perplexed by the Gemara's question over here, because we saw earlier, in last Perek, that when it came to selling a Betzemed and a Bakar, over there the Gemara asked the question, what about the money? What about the value? And you should figure out, when you buy an oxen and a yoke, the prices are different. So if he meant the oxen with the yoke, or the yoke without the oxen, by the price, you should be able to determine what he sold over there. So why over there does the Gemara say the Rabbanim believe that money is not a determinant? There was a dissenting opinion, but that was an individual. The Rabbim, the Chachamim believe money or price is never a determinant of what you sold. Yet over here, Gemara takes it without even questioning it that you could use the price as a mechanism for determining. So here you have numerous answers in the Rishonim. The Rashbam over here describes the difference as being money cannot determine what type of person you are. What the money can determine is once we know what type of person you are, then we can determine which of the two items you did. So for instance, back earlier in the Gemara where it discussed it, it was trying to figure out whether when he purchased the yoke, did he purchase the yoke with the oxen or did he purchase the yoke without the oxen in it? Over there we have different types of people in this city. Some people in the city call it etzemed, and they mean semed vibakar. Some people call it etzemed, they mean just the yoke. So now we have to figure out what type of guy this is. We have no idea whether he's a guy when he says the word semed, he means yoke and yoxen, or is he a guy when he says he means yoke, he means a yoke. So now given that, you can't use price to figure out what type of individual he is. On the other hand, here, we know what type of individual he is. He's an individual that buys oxen for shechita, and he buys oxen for plowing. Since he buys for both, now money is not determining what type of person he is. He's trying to determine which of the two possible options that he took. Because he's equally a buyer of these animals for both purposes. Now we want to determine which of those two purposes that the price can determine. So that's the way the Rashbam differentiates. It's the differentiation between defining the person or defining a term that you can't use money for. On the other hand, once we know the definitions, then money can be determined to figure out which of the two definitions he used. The Baalei HaTosafot suggest, and other Rishonim have different nuances of this, is that the money cannot be used to override a rove or override a chazaka, which is back there, you have the rove of the individuals buy it with a word meaning the following, and now possibly this guy is amongst the minority that call it something else. Number two is the sale already took place, and now we're trying to determine what happened. So you have two things working against the buyer over here. The first is that the majority of people are buyers without the term including bakar. And number two is that the seller already has the money in his hands. So now he has a rove against him and he has a chazaka against him. You want to use money, the price, to override that? No way. Price is not strong enough to override a rove and a chazaka. On the other hand, if price is put together with one of those two items, then you can use it to override. Which is price can be, I would call it, an ancillary proof. It cannot be the primary proof. If it is the primary proof, it will fail. If it is used as an addition or a ancillary proof to bolster the strength of another proof, then it will work. So in our case over here, you have that possibility, which is rove people buy shvarim the raja for plowing, and you have a chazaka against him, which is that the individual has the money. The mocher already has the money in his hands. So now you have rove versus chazaka. We already discussed that sugya earlier, whether rove and chazaka, which governs. But over here now, with the rove, he also has the price on his side. So now rove plus price can override chazaka. Because there now the price is not trying to undermine other proofs or other mechanisms for determination, but rather it's bolstering one of them. In that case, money or price can be used. So that's another possible answer to the question of why this Gemara is differentiated from the other Gemara. The other Rishonim, including the Ramban, explain that money can be used as a bolstering proof, but cannot change the facts. So over there, by the case of Tzemed and Bakar, he said the word Tzemed, and now we want to include Bakar in it. The word in its simplest form, Tzemed, means a yoke and not a Bakar. Now you want to use money to tell us that the word Tzemed doesn't mean Tzemed, but means Tzemed and Bakar? That you can't do. Over here, on the other hand, the shore was sold. That's not the question. The question is, what type of shore was sold? Over there, damim can be machriya. Over there, money can help us understand which shore was sold. So if it's a question about what was sold, then money can't help us out. Was this included? Was this not included? But if the sale is certain, and now we just want to know what type of sale it was, then money can be helpful. Or again, in a more nuanced way, the Ramban says that if it contradicts the simple meaning of the word, then money can't be used as a determinant. On the other hand, over here, where the money is not in any way undermining the definition of shore, it's just giving more particular definition to shore, over there money can be used as a factor to determine what had happened. The Rimi Gash differentiates between whether we need the data mocher or not. In a situation where the intent of the seller and the intent of the buyer is important, then money can't be a determining factor. On the other hand, in a case where we only need to know the intent of the buyer, the intent of the seller is irrelevant, then in that case, money can be a determining factor. The seller wants to sell the shor irrespective of what the buyer wants to use it for. So over there, the mocher's intent is really irrelevant over here. The only thing we want to know was the buyer's intent. There, the Rimi Gash says money can help us determine what the outcome is. In the case back by the Tzemen and the Bakar, there we want to know what the buyer thought when he bought it. We also want to know what the seller was thinking when he used that terminology. Over there, money cannot be used as a determining factor. All right. So Gemara says, lo tzricha, the case here is, diyakir bisro, v'kam b'dmei radio. An unusual market circumstance by which the price of meat had risen so much that at this point, you're on equal footing. the price would not be determinant because it would be the same price to buy a shor for its meat as to buy a shor for plowing. If that's the case, what's the difference? Why does the buyer care? He can get the same money back if he sells the shor right now. The shor is worth the same amount, whether he bought it for basar, whether he bought it for plowing. So now he got a shor that was worth that amount. He should be indifferent between whether he got a shor that plows or a shor for meat. In either case, he has his money in hand. His money's worth in hand. Mar says, nafkamina the tircha. There is a tircha that he's going to have to undertake. The Rashbam says he's going to have to sell the shor. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here says, now he's going to have to sell the shor and then buy another one in order to plow with. So he has to go through all this trouble to get his money back and then get what he wants. So the nafkamina is he doesn't have to undergo all this trouble to get what he really wanted. Yes, in terms of monetary loss, he's not going to suffer any monetary loss because they're both worth the same amount. And he can monetize the ox for its meat for the same price and not lose any money. But he needs an ox to plow his field. So now he's going to have to go sell that ox, buy another ox, and then get it hitched up to his plow. That's a lot of work, but he thought that's what he bought up front. So that tirchor, that undertaking is the nafkamina between them. The Baal Yatosafot say that you could have come up with other nafkaminot, including the fact that at the time of purchase, they were the same price. But later on, the price of meat goes back down or depreciates, and now he's no longer able to monetize it for the value that was equal to what he purchased it for. So at this point, there is a monetary nafkamina between them because the price is no longer the same. So yes, at the time that he bought it, his purchase price could not determine what it was. But at this point, it matters what he bought it for because only one of the two reasons is the price, really the value for what he got. And if he was wrong and the guy sold him it for meat, he can't get his money back at this point. So those are other ways to come up with the nafkamina. Where it says, all right, hechidomi, what exactly is the circumstance? If the seller can't repay him the money. So instance here, he says, listen, this is a mekach ta'ot, I want my money back, give me my money back. But the guy says, I don't have any money to pay you. So he says, la'akev Torah mezuzeh, let him keep the shor as collateral to get his money back, or in essence, he's not out any money. Gemara says, okay, there's tircha involved over here, but the worst situation is that he ends up with the shor, and he has his money's worth because of this phrase, da'amre inche, mari reshutech, when you get to your debtor, pare ephra, take whatever he gives you. Meaning that when you have a debtor that's out there and he's supposed to repay you money, then if he can't bring the money and he hands you something else, you say, thank you very much. You don't say, no, you keep it and bring me the money when you have it. Because when he gives you an object, at least you have what you need in hand. You have the equal repayment in hand. Or in essence, it's a money equivalent. So what's the story over here? If he has no means by which to repay you, then what's the guy's choice? The only choice he has is to keep the shor in order to get repayment of what is owed to him. And so in the end, there's no benefit in any claim, whether you hold like Rav or Shmuel, whether it's a mekach ta'ot or not a mekach ta'ot, the end game is you're going to have to keep the shor and deal with the shor because this guy has no way or means to pay you back. Now, there was an alternate girsa over here. You can see that already in the top of the Baal Yatosafot. Omeri, the shapir garis, that the girsa over here should be the letno lahanu zuzeh. If he doesn't have that money, the Rashbam took that girsa out or was upset by that girsa, and that's why we don't have it in our Gemara, but he quotes it in the name of the Rabbeinu Chananel. And it says there that if he doesn't have the money in hand, then what do you want him to do? The implications of that are what bother the Rashbam, because he says, why does it matter that if the sale price was, let's say, 100, and he has 100 zuz in his hands, but it's not the 100 zuz that you gave him, you paid him 100 zuz, he did whatever he wants with it, but he's got another 100 zuz in his pocket, why should it matter? Money is completely fungible. Nobody expects to get the same coins or the same bills back. And so therefore, if he doesn't have the money that you gave him, he has other money, he should have to pay you. For that reason, the Rashbam leaves out this girsa entirely and says it's not meaningful. Whoever heard of the fact that you would have to pay back the exact money and not repay it with any cash? Cash is cash, and he should have to repay you. So therefore, he reads the Gemara like we have it here. The Baal Yatosafot say, no, it's a little different over here, because there is a possibility that you don't have to pay cash in this instance. And therefore, only if the cash is still extant, the cash or the purchase price is extant, will you have to refund the cash. But if that cash is not available, and there's other cash in this person's possession, he may not have an obligation to repay you in cash. And that has to do with a principle that the Rabbeinu Tam lays out. We saw it in the Gemara in Ketubot. We also saw it later on in Baba Kama, Baba Metzia. The Rabbeinu Tam has this principle about what are your obligations in terms of repayment. When you have to repay someone, do you have to give them cash? Or can you give them any junk off your shelf and say, here's your money? So Rabbeinu Tam, in many places, it's very interesting the way that the Bali Tosfot quoted over here. It says, Umargala befume de Rabbeinu Tam. It was a pearl of wisdom in the mouth of the Rabbeinu Tam. But the Rabbeinu Tam explains that there are three different categories when it comes to repayment. There's a repayment of a Baal Chov. A Baal Chov is a creditor and a debtor situation. If he has money or cash, he has to pay cash. Because when someone lends money, their expectation is you're going to pay them back with money or cash. If you have cash, you must repay with cash. If you don't have cash, then you can give in kind. You can give equivalents or money equivalents, or the collateral can be taken. But the primary obligation is to give cash. But if you don't have it, you can hand over whatever it is to replace the cash and pay him back. On the other hand, there is nizakim, damages, where you have an obligation to repay. In damages, there we paskin like Rav Papa and Rav Huna, that everything is classified as meitav. You have an obligation to return meitav, the best, to the individual. Well, it's the best of whatever item. Best is only meaningful in karka, where there are different qualities. By products, the Gemara says everything is classified as meitav, because you can always liquidate it somewhere else. It's close to being a money equivalent. And therefore, you can repay in any way or manner that you choose. That means that even if you have cash, you can hand him something else to replace it. You only have an obligation to compensate him with value. Money is not a part and parcel of that because meitav includes metaltalim and anything that you want to give back. There is a third category, which is that of a poel, of a worker. A worker expects to pay, get paid in cash. If you don't have cash, then not only can you not give him something else to replace it, we demand that you go and monetize that item, get the cash, and pay him in cash. There's such an obligation to give cash that you can't hand him something else. When you don't have cash, you can't say, oh, here, take this in lieu of payment. No, you have to go monetize it and give him the cash. So those are the three categories over here. So what the Balei HaTosafot point out is that in our situation, he's not a Baal Chov. He's not a debtor. If he was a debtor-creditor relationship, you'd be right. Then if he had cash, he would have to give up the cash. Here we're in a buyer-seller relationship. In a buyer-seller relationship, there's no obligation for him to provide a warranty in any way or repay it if it's a mekach to'ot in cash. If the original sale cash is intact, is extant, then he can refund it or he'll be obligated to refund it. If that cash is gone already, then he just becomes an obligated party to him to pay for damages. It's a mekach to'ot. Damages? You can pay with whatever you want. So as long as the money is still there, there will be an obligation to pay that money. Once that money's gone, even if you have other cash, no longer is there an obligation to pay. And therefore, the Balei HaTosafot want to keep that girsa in the Gemara and say that if the money is no longer extant, then the guy can basically say to him, keep the shor. That's your payment for the damages, for the mekach to'ot, because this isn't a matter of creditor and debtor relationship where he'd be obligated to give cash if he has it. And therefore, they uphold this girsa of the Rabbeinu Hananel, which the Rishbam had rejected because he says, we never find such a thing that you have a right to give somebody in lieu payment when you have cash in hand. So that's the way that the Balei HaTosafot deal with it. So Gemara says in the end, okay, either according to the Rishbam, that means he has other cash in hand, he could have repaid it, or according to the Balei HaTosafot, means that the original cash of the sale is still there, it's still extant, and he could have repaid it to you. So now there is an afkamina. Does he have an obligation to give the cash back, or is he stuck with the shor? According to Rav, there's a mekach ta'ot, and you have an obligation to pay the cash back and take the shor back. According to Shmuel, you don't have to do anything. Leave the shor with him. Rav Amar is a mekach ta'ot. It is a failed sale. But the ruba is linan. We go after the rove. The ruba, the raj is in it. And people buy on rove. In the majority, they buy a shor for plowing. And since the rove governs over here, rove will tell us that it should have been a shor for plowing. Even if it wasn't articulated, that should have been your assumption based on the rove. Since we have to go after rove now, the seller is the burden of proof to show that it wasn't sold for that purpose or that he specifically stated that it is not for that purpose or that the buyer asked for something else. Otherwise, the buyer has the upper hand over here and he can demand a refund of his cash. And even though the mocher now is holding the money, nevertheless, Rav says we go about the rove because it's not classified as a motzi mi chaveru la varaya. Because in this case, there's an imbalance. The buyer knows why he bought the shor. The mocher can never know, unless the buyer articulated the information, he can never know why the buyer bought the shor. And therefore, his claim is always a claim of Shema and not Vadai. And for that reason, he is not classified as the mukzak in the money. And there's no motzi mechaveri olav araya here. And that's why, according to Rav, the rov governs. Shmuel malacha kiezlin and bataruba. When do we invoke the principle of majority? Be isura. That's only in dealing with issues of isur. Like, for instance, meat. You find a piece of meat out on the street. There are 9 kosher butchers in town, 1 non-kosher butcher. You go bataruba. You assume that the meat that is out there is from the kosher butcher store, because ala rov, they were kosher butchers. That's where we use rov to be vehicle for adjudication. But bimona, lo, when it comes to monetary matters, rov is not significant or relevant in those situations. Now, the problem that arises from that, it's raised by the Balei Tosafot and the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it's raised by other Rishonim over here, which is that when it comes to Beit Din, the way that Beit Din functions is, after the case is brought and all the litigants have presented their cases, the judges then decide what should be the outcome of the case. We know that you need an odd number of judges on the Beit Din because majority rules. That means that in monetary matters, we do use a majority to make a determination. What is Shmuel going to do with the fact that adjudications are made based on the majority of judges' decisions? And therefore, you are using a majority or a rule by Mamon. So there are different ways to deal with that. One of which is to say that there's a difference between what's called the ruba de ita kaman, the ruba de leita kaman. The difference between a rove that is in front of us and a rove that is not in front of us. A rove that's not in front of us means that it's a statistical reality. We know that if you took a poll of all individuals out there, on majority they would do this, or on majority they would buy a shor, an ox for plowing. That's a ruba de leita kaman. We're using a statistical majority. There, Shmuel says, that's not relevant in these cases. On the other hand, when you're dealing with judges, you're dealing with a majority that is in front of you. It's not a statistical determination based on the majority of people out there. It's in front of us. We know how many judges are in front of us, and we know how each judge voted. And based on that, you have a majority that sits in front of you. You're not using majority in a statistical sense. You're using majority in a determinative sense. And because of that, it's different. A rove that is based on statistics, or based on what majority of people out there would have done, that is not helpful in a case of Mamon, or is not usable in a case of Mamon. On the other hand, a rove that is right in front of us, meaning that we know how many judges are here, how each judge voted, that type of majority can be determinant. That's one way to deal with it. Another way to deal with it, the Balei Tosafot and Sanhedrin use this, the Reb Chaim speaks about this, and in enhancing that, which is that, how do you look at a Beit Din that votes, for instance, you have 3 Dayanim, and they vote 2-1, that the case, or the outcome of the case should be the following. Do we say now that this is a Beit Din that voted 2-1, and on the majority it was 2-1, and now you have 2 judges, and 2 judges will govern in the case? Or do we say when you have 2 judges versus 1, once that decision has been made, the one judge in essence disappears. It's kedaleta. It's as if he doesn't exist anymore, and then it becomes a unanimous decision. So it's a question of how you view rov versus miut. Do you view rov versus miut as I have a majority and a minority, and the majority governs? The minority doesn't disappear, it's just that I have a majority and minority. Majority governs when it comes to that decision. But the minority is still around. That's what Shmuel says. That can't be determinant. And because majority and minority, the minority is still there. But in adjudication, in a court case, it's different. When 2 judges versus 1 judge say, this is the outcome of the case, that one judge is kelekta. It's as if he doesn't exist anymore. It's as if there's now a unanimous decision by the Beit Din that these 2 judges, who are the only judges in the case, have determined that this is the outcome. And so that's a different view of majority. Majority can be majority versus minority, or majority can be majority, minority doesn't exist anymore, that becomes a unanimous decision. And in that way, he makes a differentiation between a case like this, where Shmuel say no, versus a case of a adjudication, a court case, where the majority of judges will govern because the minority or the minority judges will disappear from the case, and therefore there will be unanimity in their decision. Or the way that other Rishonim explain it, it has to do with the different way in which you're using rov. Rov cannot be used to undermine a chazaka. The person who has the object in his hand is mukzak in it. Now you want to use a rov to take it away from him? That you can't do. On the other hand, if you want to know the efficacy of a claim, then Rove can tell us whether this claim is efficacious or not. And that's what the Beit Din is doing. The Beit Din is telling us, is this claim a valid claim, or is this not a valid claim? There you can use Rove to determine whether the Tana is a valid Tana. So Rove is being used in different ways. It will not undermine Chazakah. It will be a stamp of approval when it comes to a claim that is being made. And that's why by a Beit Din it will work, the Rove, and why in situations of Mamon, Shmuel said that Rove does not work. So now the Gemara continues along these lines, asking similar questions, just bringing up different cases. The reason it's in our Gemara here is because eventually the Gemara will get to our Mishnah, which should also factor into these questions. Haisha, shenit alma, o nit garsha. A woman who is widowed or divorced, v'omeret. And she says, bitula niseti. I got married when I was a bitula. That means that my ketubah is 200 zuz, and I'm entitled to 200 zuz at this point as payment for my ketubah. V'omer, and the husband says, lo, kiela mananisatich. I married you as a widow, and therefore you're only entitled to 100 zuz. Obviously, this is in the case where the divorce happened. In the case that she's a widow, it'd be very hard for the husband to tell us what happened at the time of the marriage. But the assumption here is that there's no ketubah. If there is a ketubah, then all of this is moot, because you just look in the ketubah to find out what she is entitled to. So it has to be either in a case where she claims she lost the ketubah, or a case where a city where they don't give ketubot, and the get or the death certificate are your rights to collect on the ketubah, and you don't need a ketubah. But without a ketubah, we're uncertain as to whether this woman is a betula, or this woman was an almanah, be'ula already when she got married. The difference will be how much she's entitled to her in a ketubah. She's entitled to 200 zuz or 100 zuz. She makes a claim for 200. He's saying back to her, no, it's 100 zuz. Im yesh edim. If we have witnesses, she yatza behinuma v'rosha parua. If we have witnesses that she went out with, hinuma is a major machloket in the Rishonim, in the Gemara Ketubot, as to what it is. We will loosely translate it over here as a veil, that she went out with a veil, v'rosha parua, and her hair was uncovered. The way that the Rishbam reads it over here is, or her hair was uncovered. So she wore something that was indicative of the fact that she was a betula. Because the betulot, when they went out, they had a certain, whether it was a veil, certain hair band, something that was put in their hair that was indicative of the fact that she was a single woman. Or rosha parua, which is that she went out with uncovered hair. Only betulot, only unmarried betulot, go out with their hair uncovered. On the other hand, when it comes to a be'ula, once a woman is a be'ula, there's an obligation to cover her hair. From here, it would seem that that obligation exists, irrespective of whether she's married or not. If she's a be'ula, she would have to cover her hair, and therefore, rosha parua is an indication of the fact that this woman was a be'ula. So that's if you say or. If you say and, then that's not necessarily the case, meaning that if she both had the hinuma and her hair was uncovered, then it's an indication of betula, then rosha parua is no longer a differentiating factor between a betula and a betula, because it's not only rosha parua, it's also hinuma. But they have witnesses that she went out with whatever normal brides who were betulot went out with to the wedding. Tubata matayim. She gets the 200. Tosfot over here says, why don't we just believe the baal from etzad of amigo? Migo, that he could have said, parati, I paid it, and she would have no way to show evidence to the contrary because she has no document of ketubah. And so therefore, why is it over here that we don't believe the Baal when he says, I owe her 100, because he could have argued, parati, that I paid the whole amount, and we would have believed him. Through that Migo, he should be believed. So the Baal Tosafot say that Rav must be holding like the position in the Gemara Ketubot that says that the ketubah, or the Ikar ketubah, which is the 100 zuz or 200 zuz, is a result of the get. The ketubah is only necessary to get you the tosefet ketubah, or that which is beyond the 100 and 200. And therefore, there over here, he can't make a claim of parati, because the woman has the get in her hand. That get will entitle her to the 100 zuz or the 200 zuz, irrespective of whether the husband says parati, not parati, irrespective of whether she has a ketubah or not. So therefore, the husband doesn't have a right to make a claim of parati, and that would then undermine the migo, and that's why we don't necessarily believe the husband over here. Taimo de ikaidim. The reason that we give her the 200 is because she's got witnesses to back up her claim. How lucky edim lo? Without witnesses, we would not believe her. V'amai le'malech achar rov nashim. Go after the majority of the women in the world. Rov nashim bitulot nisot. And the majority of women in the world are bitulot when they get married. If you took a census, you took a statistical poll of people getting married, Alarov, the women that are getting married are betulot. Probably has changed today in the modern society, but at least in their time, that was the case, that the majority of women were betulot. So why do I need Edim to back her up? She has the Rov, according to Rav, to back her up. This would seem to be a proof against Rav's position that Rov governs in Dinei Mimonot. Amar Avina, Mishum De'ikah LeMeimar, Rov Nafshim Betulot Nisot. You're right. Statistically, the majority of women who get married as betulot. Umiyot Almanot. On the other hand, there are a minority of women who are widows. V'cho Aniseit Betula, and a woman who gets married as a betula, Yesh Lakol. That is something that is known out there. It's something that is a fact that is spread because of the news of someone getting married. It's information that is in the public sphere and has nothing to do with Rove or not Rove. It's just information that gets out there. The way that the Rashbam says, "Mitoch sheyesh simcha b'nisuei betula," says there is such a great celebration in the marriage of betula, "Niskarim ba b'nei adam." People have memories of it, or they remember seeing the wedding, remember seeing the wedding procession. It is something of a public nature by which people would be aware of this information. So over here, Zo, Hoyo V'ein Lakol, over here, we can't seem to find this information in the public sphere. Itra La Ruba. Therefore, the Rove has now been undermined by the fact that this call doesn't exist. Majority of women who get married are betulot. Women, when they get married as betulot, have this information be out in the public sphere. Over here, we're missing that information. Well, if we're missing that information, that starts to cast aspersions on the fact that she was amongst the Rove that were betulot. Because if it was true, then that information should be out in the public sphere. Now, obviously, you don't need Edim to do that, because that's what we have here. We have Edim coming to say that. If that was the case, there'd be no question. The fact that we find this information out has to be something that's just out in the public sphere. It doesn't have to be real Edim that are coming to testify the fact that you got married. It's to be people saying that they remember, or it's information that's well known out there. But over here, the fact that we demand Edim is because the Rove is no longer a valid mechanism for determination, because we've now, in some way, undermined the value of the Rove, because she's missing a part of that puzzle that should have come together. Mar says, "E kol nisuot betulot yesh lehen kol." Wait a minute, it should work just the verse now. If all women who get married as betulot, that information is well known in the public sphere, and that information's missing here, that should be determinant against her, and then we should pass it against her. Ki kedim, my havi. And when the Edim show up, we should throw them out. Since this information is not known in the public sphere, these Edim are lying. Because otherwise, the information should have been in the public sphere. The fact that it's not should mean that she didn't get married to Betula, and these Edim are just lying about it. So my says, no. You misunderstood. Ella, rov nisuot betulot yesh lahen kol. First of all, the majority of women who get married as betulot have a kol. Vezovo in la kol itra la ruba. So here there are two roves working. Number one is a rove that majority of women who get married are betulot. Number two is those women that are betulot, a rove of them have a kol that is associated with their marriage. But it's not 100% of the time. So now you have, if this woman was a betula, then number one, she'll be amongst the rove of women. Is she also should have a kol that is associated, because the majority of women who get married to betulot also have this information in the public sphere. The met information is missing, that undermines the rove, or the other rove, which is the fact that majority get married when they are betulot. But now when the Edim show up, these Edim may not be lying, because she might be amongst the minority of women who don't have a kol that says that they were married as betulot. So now you have the ability, because of that minority, to say that the Edim are telling the truth, and this woman is amongst the minority. Now, you're not going to say that automatically. You're only going to say that if you have evidence to back up the fact that she's amongst the minority. Otherwise, we're going to assume she's from the majority. The majority have this information in the public sphere. Her lack of having that in the public sphere undermines the other rove, which is that majority of women who get married are betulot. So here, that's how we get rid of the problem of rove. That's why for Rav, the answer is you need Edim. But why are the Edim believed over here? Because of the minority of women, where that information is not in the public sphere. This woman might be amongst that minority, and the Edim are basically saying that. She is amongst that minority. We were there, and we know she got married as a betula, even though you don't have that information in the public sphere. And that drops now as being a question on Rav. Now, it's still clear here that the two robes that we're speaking about are of a different nature. That's true of any majority that you speak about. You've got a majority that's 51%, and you're going to have a majority that is 91%. they have different qualitative majorities. And so what the Baalei Tosafot point out over here, that with regards to the Rov, that Rov Nashim, majority of women that get married are Betulot, that is a much stronger Rov than the Rov of Kol, which is that the Rov of Betulot that get married, there is a Kol, that information is out in the public sphere, that is a weaker type of Rov. And therefore, if we have a deem that come along and support the original Rov, which is the Rov that most women get married are Betulot, then that will override the Rov of the majority of Betulot that get married, that information is in the public sphere. But the Baalei Tosafot go on to explain that it doesn't have to be even real edut. It has to be an edut that people say, I remember when I was a little kid that I saw this. We don't know full-fledged edut over here because of the strength of the first rove, which is the rove that majority of women who get married are betulot, that together with subpar edut can override the poorer quality rove, which is the majority of betulot. That's information that is out in the public sphere. And so for that reason, Baalei Tosafot point out that the Gemara calls it a giloi milto bi'almahi, that when edim or individuals come to testify to that fact, they're not really giving testimony, they're just clearing up information for us, exposing information that otherwise we knew was true. And that shows you the difference qualitatively between the two roves that we're speaking about here. That's what he says, v'yesh lamar, dafakav deitra la ruba mikom akom, ruba derov nashim betulot nisaot adif, Mirov nisot betulah yesh la kol v'sagi begluye milta b'alma. Therefore, it's enough with just a gluye milta. Tashma. Next case, case that we've again seen before a number of times, which is in the sugyot of simpon. A woman is entitled to eat truma from the time they ever sin because she becomes the kinyan kaspo of the husband. And if the husband's a kohen, she should be able to eat truma. The chamim were gozer, put in a sakana that a woman may not eat truma until she's fully married, until she has nisuin. The Gemara over there has two explanations as to what the problem is. One possible reason is that we're afraid that she's going to take the truma. She's living with her father's house now because she's still in Arusa. She only moves in with her husband when she's in Nisua. So during that time period, she's going to be eating in her father's house. She's going to be eating truma. If she's a nice girl, she's going to give some of that to her brother, some of that to her father, and they can't eat it because it is truma. So that's one answer. The other answer the Gemara gives is mipnei simpon. Simpon means that there is a mekach ta'ut. She's going to have mumim that are going to upset the husband to the point where he's going to say, I didn't bargain for this. This is not what I wanted. And so the Gemara over there goes through which types of mumim, not mumim bigaloi, which he can see, obviously, because then he knows about them and he accepted them, but mumim shebiseter, mumim that are not visible to him, and then he figures them out, and there's certain mumim which are enough of a problem that he can say that it was a mekach ta'ut. If it's a mekach ta'ut, then retroactively the kiddushin were not kiddushin, and she wasn't entitled to eat truma. For that reason, we say that he can't give her truma at the time it was seen. After nisuin, we say that he's accepted everything. Because whether it's the chibat biyah that makes him forgive all the mumim, or we assume by that point in time his relatives have seen her in the bathhouse and could have given him the information, at that point we assume that he has accepted it and there's no longer a mekach ta'ut. In that sugya, the Gemara talks about simpon ba'avadim, simpon by slaves. Now the Gemara says, why should there ever be simpon by slaves? By slaves, if it's a mum shibigalui, if it's an obvious visible mum, then the buyer knows about it and he accepted it. If it's a non-visible mum, then why does the buyer care? He bought the eved for it's his work. He didn't buy him to marry him or to have him marry his daughter. He's buying a slave to work. So if he has a mum that is under his clothing, why does he care? As long as it doesn't impede his ability to do work, it shouldn't matter at all. So the Gemara says, how do you ever have simpon? How do you ever have this problem by a vadim where there is a problem in the sale because there was information that was misleading? So the Gemara there says, Hamucher eved lechaveiro. I'll tell you a case. V'nimsa ganav. He's found out to be a thief. O kabyustus. The way that Rashi translates it in the other Gemarot and the way that Rishbam says over here, he's a gonev nefashot. He's a kidnapper. So you find out after you buy the eved, you find out that he is a thief, or you find out that he's a kidnapper. The Gemara says there, higio, too bad, you got him. What you bought, you got. Listim mizuyain, if he is an armed robber, o muhtav lemalchut, or he is wanted by the government. He has a death warrant out on him from the government. So in that case, clearly, he's not buying the eved for this purpose because he sold him a dead man walking. This person is going to be killed either because he killed someone else or because the government has a warrant out for his death or the government has a warrant out to take him into custody, and you're not going to see him anymore. And that's not something he could have anticipated. So here it's clearly something that is a mekach ta'ut, and he has a right of refund in this situation. Then the buyer can say back to the seller, here's your item back, take him back as it is, I want my money back. So here you find a case of simpon by abadim or mum by abadim. There is something that could be a mum. Reisha, my time, what's the reason in the Reisha that he can't say that it was a false sale? Why can't he say that, listen, I didn't buy an eved that was supposed to be a thief. I didn't buy an eved that was a kidnapper. So, love, la mishom, deruba hochi itnu. Isn't that because the majority of slaves are engaged in this activity? Majority of slaves are thieves. If you think about the Mishnah and Avot, we start saying Pirkei Avot now. Mishnah Avot says, marbe avadim, marbe gozel. If you have more avadim in your household, you're going to have more theft in your household. It's a well-known thing that slaves are avadim are thieves. So, the majority of slaves are thieves. So, it shouldn't be a surprise to you when you bought it that this slave is a thief. Now, the Baalei Tosafot say, well, it would be a surprise if he was a kidnapper. A kidnapper is not something that you would say rove, and therefore he rejects this view of Rashi and the Rashbam, and favors the explanation of the Rabbeinu Hananel that a kavustos is a gambler, and not a kidnapper. So he says, oh, what's the big deal? So he's a gambler, why should that matter to you? He says, no, because gamblers rack up debts. And then there are peaceful people chasing after them because of the debts that they've accumulated. And because of that, they don't want to appear in the mornings. They try to hide out away from their creditors. You know, that gambling leads to bad things. And in essence, it becomes the same problem of gneva, which is that they're stealing or they have outstanding debts and they're running away from them. But it's the same thing as a gneva. And that's why the Baalei Tosafot favor that explanation, especially here, which is, that makes sense that majority of slaves have this. And it would be something that was expected and maybe tenable. But if you say he's a kidnapper, that's something that's really maybe beyond the pale. That's something that you can't accept. Now, if that's the case, there's a question on Shmuel. Because now we're going after the rove. We're assuming the sale goes through because majority of slaves have this problem. That means now majority governs. In Dinei Mamononot, that supports Rav. It's against Shmuel's position. Where it says, lo, kula hachayitnu. It's not a rove. They all are like this. Meaning that it's not just a majority. It's a given. It's such a given that you have to assume that it's true 100% of the time. We're not letting rove govern over here, but rather, for Shmuel, this is a 100% fact. And the Rishbam points out, the only time a mum undermines a sale is in a case when the buyer doesn't have the information or is unaware of the information. But if 100% of the time avadim are ganavim, or they are kabustus, then there's nothing to speak about. He knows that's what he's getting. He can assume that's what he's getting, and the lokach's not misled in any way because that information is out there. It's out there because there's no majority-minority, and maybe he's part of the minority. There's 100%. It's 100%, then there's no question about it, and the sale goes through. Okay, we're going to stop here, two lines down on the top of Tzadik Gimel Amud Aleph, and the Gemara is going to continue to try to work through this issue of rov, and obviously it's going to get to our Mishnah, which also involves a case of rov, which has to do with whether an ox is used for shkita, or al rov, whether it's used for plowing.